This is the Bad Apples, episode 18 of season 5. Hi everyone, my name is Klaatu, and this is the Bad Apples, and if this is your first episode listening, it's probably not going to be the best one to start out on. This is basically the second half of episode 17, so really not 18, it's more like season 5, episode 17, you know, point 5 or point 75 or point 525 or something like that. So let's listen, shall we? All right, listener feedback. We actually got a lot of listener feedback. I say we, meaning I. I actually got a lot of listener feedback on that past episode, the one about the Bash stuff. And that's always really cool because I really do know that the technical how-tos are just really, really important and good and kind of like you really can't have enough of them. And I think that in a perfect world, there would be technical how-tos well done in technical how-tos on podcasts like all the time. If I could just do that all the time, that would be what I would be doing. In real life, it's a little bit harder to do that because in order for me to do a technical how-to really well, I have to know how to do it. And in order for me to learn how to do stuff, I have to really, really play around on some aspect of something technical. So people apparently appreciated the Bash tutorial, and so did I, frankly. So a lot of people emailed, and a lot of people spoke to me in IRC and all that other good stuff. So I'm not going to just like list everyone who said thanks, because that would be silly. But I'm going to read a couple of the emails that were kind of interesting, I think. So Doug wrote, and he's emailed me before. I honestly don't know if I've ever read one of his emails on the show, but if not, you know, congratulations, Doug. This is your first email on the show. But otherwise, it's old Doug again. We all know Doug. So he was talking and he was saying that while the for loop that we did in the Bash tutorial was good and neat and all that other good stuff, he wanted to contrast it, I guess, with the way that it could be done in Python. This is really interesting to me, and I mean, Python I have much respect for. I really do like Python conceptually, I just don't really understand it, and I did a whole book, like, it was like, I don't know, you know, number of pages on Python, and I still just don't understand how to start from scratch, you know, just like sit down and say, I want to do, you know, so-and-so. I still don't get exactly how to just sit down and just start coding. Someday, it's going to click. But for now, we'll leech off of Doug. So you open up the Python program with the hash and then an exclamation mark. So what is that? Shebang, supposedly. So shebang slash user slash bin slash Python. That's simple enough. That's just like a shell script, right? And then you do an import of glob. This tells Python to import a certain module. And glob is a library that reads file patterns from directories. Why it's called glob, I don't know. How you're supposed to know that glob exists, I don't know. How you're supposed to know that glob is the library module that you want to use, I don't know. This is why I'm not a Python programmer. But that's what you do. You say import glob, and then Python says, oh, okay, I'll grab that module and load in all the underlying code associated with it. It's cool. It's cool stuff. And then you say outfile equals open parentheses, quote, TOC, like table of contents, dot output, end quote, comma, space, quote, W, quote, end parentheses. No clue what any of that means. That's why Doug wrote it. I didn't. And now what you want to do is you want to iterate over all the files that match wildcard.txt, you know, asterisk.txt. So you say for file name in glob.glob, parentheses, quote, asterisk.txt, end quote, in parentheses, colon, outfile.write, parentheses, open, parentheses, file name, close parentheses, dot readline, empty parentheses, close parentheses. Okay? So, yeah, I'm doing a really great job of explaining this, aren't I? So, and I'll post all this stuff on the site so that you can actually see this, and then Doug can sue me for stealing his code. That obviously processes it and then puts the output stuff into the output file. Now, where and how it knows to just look at the first line, I have no clue. And it's apparently the readline method, which is there in that last line. Outfile.write, parentheses open, parentheses file name, close parentheses dot read line, empty parentheses, end parentheses. So the read line reads one line from the file, and then it passes that out to the outer method, which would be the outfile.write, and that takes that line and then puts it into the output file. So he says that it could be more explicitly written. That last line would be f equals open parentheses file name, line equals f dot read line parentheses, and then outfile.write parentheses line. So hearing it that way actually makes it quite clear, I think. So if you've got like f equals open parentheses file name, so something just opened up whatever was the asterisk.txt, and then you say, okay, so the line, a variable called line, is going to equal the f.readline. So now you've got that one, by default, one, the first line of that file has been assigned to the variable of this word, line. And then you have the glob doing an outfile.write, so it's going to write a line to the outfile. So what do you want it to write to the outfile? Well, parentheses line, which is that variable that we just assigned. So that actually makes a lot of sense to me. That was a really like fantastic little tutorial that Doug did. I almost wish he would just record that for Hacker Public Radio or something and post it, because that made a whole lot of sense to me. And if I felt like I knew more about this stuff enough to speak about it authoritatively, I would just steal his whole email and make it into a Bad Apple segment. But unfortunately, I don't feel like, I feel like I would be kind of BSing my way through it for a fair amount of that, so I don't really want to do that. Speaking of BSing my way through it, Jay Lindsay and I think it was Soundchaser, who, Jay Lindsay is kind of the, if you've never met Jay Lindsay, you might have heard him on Kernel Panics or Linux Cranks, but like in real life, this guy actually, he just basically knows a lot. So if I do something technical and I don't hear anything bad about it from Jay Lindsay, I figure I must have gotten some stuff at least in one way right. But he specifically said that the Bash tutorial was good, which made me really happy. So he also gave me this new trick of creating functions in Bash, which is really cool. And I'm going to do more investigation of that and hopefully do a follow-up to the beginning Bash tutorial that you just heard last episode with a couple more tricks, including like this whole function thing that he was telling me about. Unfortunately, I do not know enough about it yet to actually talk intelligently about it. Once I learn more about that, I will do another Bash tutorial. More stuff about the Sansa fuse. This is all kind of interesting stuff, and I feel that it's really important to kind of cover all this stuff, because I did do a whole feature on the subject and kind of made a big deal about it, but I don't want people to go into flashing their Sansa fuse completely blindly, thinking that it's just going to be a picnic. So Hammer wrote me again and said that his clip is working great. He's got a Sansa clip with Rockbox, and it's fantastic, and it's going really well. However, and initially his Sansa fuse was working great, but now he's saying that now it's not working. His fuse is kind of like, is a brick now, which surprised me a little bit, because it was exactly what happened to me. You know, it worked, it worked, it worked, and then suddenly it was a brick. And then, of course, in my case, it worked again. So I'm not sure what's going on with Hammer's fuse. I did email him and reiterate what I said on the show. I think it was just last episode. And I said, look, try plugging the fuse in later once the battery has completely exhausted itself, and try to clear out 90 megabytes. He says that doesn't sound like his problem, and he might be right. I'm not sure. I hope it is his problem, and I hope that it's not actually a brick. I would feel a tiny bit guilty about that. I don't know if I made a big enough deal about how unstable the Rockbox port to the fuse was. So hopefully everything's okay. He said that he actually also took it apart, which is funny, because that's exactly what I did. What is it about geeks? Something becomes a brick and you immediately think, gee, I'll just take it apart randomly. Not that you can actually do anything, you know, it's like, oh, here's the problem. This little chip got loose. Let me just reseat that. You know, no, that's probably not why it's a brick. So whatever the case, he took his apart as well, which I found quite humorous. And it's back together now, he says, so he might be able to, he's going to try, you know, some other things. So related to that, Doru wrote me again, and Doru is the guy who had written me about some of the specifics of the fuse, and he actually gave me some interesting tips on little tricks that you can do with the fuse that I did not know about. So one of the things that he points out about the battery is that when the battery runs completely low on the fuse, one of the things that the fuse attempts to do, or one of the things that the fuse needs to do before you can actually use it, even on a computer, is it needs to get a little bit more juice in the battery. So if you plug in a completely dead batteried fuse into your computer, it's not going to pop up on your computer until first it gets a little bit of juice in its battery, and then it will talk to your computer. So what he's guessing, and it sounds exactly right, is that when I bricked, or you know, ostensibly bricked my fuse, and I set it down for a while and just kind of ignored it, it probably used up every last bit of battery power that it needed. So then I plugged it into one computer and nothing happened, and I probably just kind of ignored it for a little while, and then I plugged it into another computer, and you know, all this time it's like getting a little bit more juice into its battery, right? So finally, once I plug it into another computer, it just so happens that it's gotten enough battery power now that magically it works on this third computer that I try. It has nothing to do with the fact that it was a different computer, a different version of Linux or anything like that. It was just that it didn't have any battery, and then after enough attempts of setting it down and kind of trying to make it come up and trying to mount it and stuff like that in the command line, in the meantime it's charging, and so finally it gets enough charge to actually turn on. So that is nice. And he points out as well that forcing a SANSA to shut down is a matter of holding the power button, you know, holding the little power switch on, you know, down until, I think, 20 seconds. It used to be 10 seconds. They lengthened it to 20 seconds. So if you can't force it to power down, you might not be holding it long enough. I'm pretty sure I was holding it down for a very long time, but maybe not. He also told me, and this was really cool, that if you want to charge a fuse and not have it mount, you know, you don't want it to switch over to the SANSA firmware and mount on your computer and all that other stuff, you can do that from Rockbox. So you can plug it in with a USB cable, but you keep the center button pressed. So if you're holding the center button down and you plug it in, Rockbox will not give you USB functionality, and it will just charge. So that's a really cool tip. Now, he points out here that was kind of why he was saying that the Rockbox interface is not exactly user-friendly, because there are so many little tricks that people just kind of can't know one way or the other. Now, I kind of disagree again with him, because there are such tricks on all media players, you know? Like, I've met so many people who have no idea that on an iPod, and I'm talking about iPod with Apple firmware, that if you hold down the middle button and the menu button, then it will reset. And if you hold down the middle button and the play button, it will shut down. I know so many people who have no idea about that trick, and they just don't know about it because it's not in any manual that I'm aware of. I don't even know how I found out about it. It was just, you know, it's just one of those things that they don't really document that well. And you probably just have to meet someone who happens to know about it to know about it. So I don't think that's a Rockbox problem. I think that's a media player problem or an interface problem. You know, there's just so many things you can do, so many combinations of possible button presses at different moments that we don't get them all. You know, they don't tell us about them all the time. Yeah, that's the Rockbox stuff. So thanks a lot, Doru, for all the tips and information. That was very cool. And then I got some email about something that I decided to do on my website the other day, and I really was surprised by the reaction. And if we're talking about like social experiments or something, it ended up being a very interesting one, but that's not what I actually intended it to be, unfortunately. So I was over at a friend's house, and we were going to go to movie-links.tv to watch some good old-fashioned copyright infringing movies online. Because Netflix would not work on Linux, right? I mean, it doesn't stream. This person had an account, a Netflix account, so in theory, we could have watched this movie on Netflix and had it, you know, streaming on our computer. We're paying for it. Everyone's getting the money that they deserve. Everyone's happy. Well, someone's unhappy. Someone's always unhappy, but most people are happy. And then, you know, it just doesn't work because Netflix decided to go with Silverlight and Microsoft decided that Silverlight wasn't worthy of or that Linux wasn't worthy of Silverlight support, and on and on. What that says about non-free software and its relationship to quote-unquote copyright infringement and stuff like that, I think that actually says something a lot different than what people would have you think. Whereas people think that you're going to resort to copyright infringement or whatever we're calling it these days just because you don't believe in paying an artist a fair wage or whatever. That simply quite often is not the case. And the case is that literally I can't get, you know, I can pay for the same service as everyone else is paying, and yet because I'm choosing to run an operating system that these companies are just ignoring, then really, you know, in order to get the value that I'm paying for, I have to go someplace that decides to use an open standard for the videos that they're posting. I mean, it's really quite as simple as that. So that's just an interesting side note. But the point is really that, so we went to movie-links.tv, and amazingly, there was this big graphic on it that says, this site has been seized by the intellectual property police, or something bizarre like that. It was really, really funny and bizarre. And, you know, to someone who doesn't really love the whole long arm of the law theory, it was kind of offensive. And I thought it was just too precious to pass up. So I grabbed the graphic and I put it on my site because I thought it was really funny. And I was really thinking that no one really went to the badapples.info because I figured, well, most people who listen to my show get the show from the RSS feed, so why would they go to my site? I know differently now. And a couple of people emailed me, which I really appreciate, actually, and I didn't mean to take advantage or to trick them or anything like that. It was not intended to be like a joke. And I left all the metadata in. You know, I mean, if you looked at the source code, you could see that it was clearly me posting the image and that it wasn't like the actual federal government posting the image over my site, because I had all my little meta tags and stuff in there. So, but I mean, you don't really do that whenever when you just go to a site. So, but Patrick Archibald, who's a really cool guy who did like this aggregation on some Google App Engine or something like that, and he did like this Ogcast lists on there and stuff. It was really cool. We talked about it on Kernel Panics. But he's a great guy, and he emails me sometimes. And in this case, he emailed me kind of like asking, like letting me know, you know, like, hey, you've got like some weird graphic on your site. Have you been hacked or what? So as it turns out, no, I hadn't been hacked except by myself. And he started a pretty funny Identica thread about it, or what, I mean, what is funny now, because we all know the truth, but it was him and Pat from Tilts and NY Bill and Claudio M, the famous host of Linux Basements, DM Frey from Myth TV. So lots of people were kind of speculating on what might have happened to my site. So believe me, that was completely unintentional, but it was actually well worth it, you know, after a while. A guy named David emailed me, and I'd never heard from David, so that was kind of neat that I met someone new yet again. And he was asking me what exactly was going on with the site, too. And the funny thing about this one was that he decided, because I guess he'd been listening to some of my old episodes where I was raving about links, the web browser links. He said, well, first of all, he wants to be listener number 133, but of course that's not possible because I don't have 133 listeners. I have 20, I think I'm up to probably 27 now, so he can be listener 28 at least. But anyway, aside from that, he says that he was using links, and he decided, oh, I should go check out the badapples.info. And wouldn't you know, for whatever reason, the one time he chose to go to the site, it was in links, and it was like probably 2 minutes after I posted that graphic. And I know it was probably that fast, because the message that he said he saw on there was something about like, get out of here, alien, or something like that, or get off our planet, alien, or something like that, because that was the original text I'd had in the alt tag. And then I changed it very, very shortly after to something else. I don't remember what. So the fact that he saw that meant that he like hit my site moments after I made the change, which is really funny. And so he emailed me asking, really, he wasn't sure if that was like a links only kind of Easter egg or something, or what was going on. So I explained. So thanks for emailing, David, and again, I apologize for telling you to get off our planet. I didn't really mean it personally. So Deep Geek wrote me, completely separate from the website debacle, and he has been playing around with a bunch of speaks tests, and the way he was doing it, he decided to go with average bitrate, which lets you choose a specific value for the bitrate instead of a instead of just using the quality flag. That's true and that's untrue because average bitrate says that it's going to be an average bitrate. So that's not actually locking in the bitrate. That's simply saying keep the average at around, you know, this much. So it's true, but it's also, you know, untrue. And then he was comparing the Speaks encoder to the Lame encoder, and I think for Aug he was using SOX. I'm not really sure. He doesn't seem to explicitly say what he was using for the AUG encoding. But it was kind of interesting because apparently, I mean, the point is that he's been doing, you know, he did a lot of different tests, I guess. And so he was finding, he did a nice little table on this, actually. And the results are interesting. So the bit rate at 64 kilobits per second for Speaks was 7.1 megabytes. For AUG, it was 14 megabytes. And then for MP3, it was 13 megabytes. For 48 kilobits per second, Speaks was again 7.1 megabytes, AUG was 12 megabytes, and MP3 was 9.9 megabytes. 32 kilobits per second, Speaks was 5.1 megabytes, AUG was 7.6 megabytes, and MP3 was 6.8 megabytes. So the difference there, I'm pretty sure, is that he's using the AVR flag for Speaks, so that's why he's got 7.1 and 7.1 at two different data rates. 64 and 48. The AUG, again, I don't know what program he's using, and I don't know his settings for it. I would want to see the actual line commands for each of these, and really analyze what exactly he was setting. But I still think it's an interesting data point that Speaks is fairly consistently. It's difficult to get Speaks files that are more than like 10 megabytes. You know, amazingly, it's just like, well, I mean, you can do it, but. You can definitely do it, but, you know, to really, I mean, if you're going for a small file, a small download, Speaks is just, it's amazing, it really is. AUG and MP3, I mean, to me, there's no difference between 14 megabytes and 13 megabytes, or 12 megabytes and 9.9 megabytes. Now, there might be, to someone with serious bandwidth issues, that might be, that kind of savings might be huge for them. I don't know, I've never really been in that situation, but I think that, I mean, obviously, if you know, encoding isn't something that you do blindly, or it shouldn't be. I mean, I know a lot of people do, but, I mean, if you know that you want to get your file down to a certain file size, then it can be done. You can do it. You know, it may be not in one command. You might have to do a test, and then do another test, and then do your actual encode. And that is, I don't know how many times I can tell people this, but that's how it's done in the industry. People don't, you don't go into Apple, into the iTunes movie store department, you know, section, and see them running automated encoding scripts. That's not what they're getting paid for, you know? I mean, monkeys do that. People don't. They do tests. They compare. They see what they can tweak here, what they can tweak there. And yeah, they've got certain principles that they start to figure out, and the more you encode, the more you understand these kinds of things. But I cringe every time I hear people who clearly don't exactly know what they're talking about sit around and compare, you know, oh, well, AUG is always smaller than MP3, and it's a better quality. Well, are you sure? I mean, what are you even talking about? What's the context? Are you talking about music? Are you talking about spoken word? Talking about
raw
music?
All I want
music?
Is
are you talking
some
about,
coffee.
You know, recorded
so go get yourself some coffee
on
and come right back,
you
and we'll end
about
the show.
That's a completely digital workflow from last year. What exactly is the context, and how can you simply say that this encoder is better than another one? And even I, who, you know, pretentiously believe I know a little bit something about encoding. Well, to be fair, I do know a little bit something about encoding. But even I don't know, like, the technical stuff. I mean, I couldn't sit down with Chris Monty of ziff.org and talk to him about encoding. I mean, the guy wrote the encoder for AUG Theora. He and I are not going to have that much to talk about. Different league entirely. So, yeah, I guess it goes back to that whole qualification, you know, like, actually qualify what you're talking about when you're talking about encoding and stuff like that, because it's just too easy to say AUG is so much better than anything else, or Speaks is so much worse than everything else, or Speaks is better than something else. It's just not necessarily true. You really have to talk about what exactly you mean, what your goal was. Are you going for file size? Are you going for quality? Are you going for a happy medium between both? And so on. So that's just my never-ending encoding quandary. another email from Jay Rullo, J-R-U-L-L-O in IRC. He emailed me and said, thanks for the bash episode. I just whipped up a command line for loop that looks for files with an underscore and runs another script against each file. It's been a while since I looked at bash scripting, and your episode refreshed my memory about what is easily accomplished on the command line. I spent 5 minutes to work out the one-liner that saved me 15 minutes of retyping commands. That's basically exactly how I use these things, Jay Rullo. I'm not a sysadmin. I don't have a whole bunch of tasks that need to be repeated every day. You know, like I don't run, let's say, a big aggregated podcast where people can upload episodes to an FTP server, and then I could script via bash, you know, my server going into that file, grabbing, or that folder, grabbing an episode, maybe the most recently posted, or just whatever, moving that over to a non-public folder, maybe doing some kind of analysis of the meta tags, or just rewriting the meta tags that I want to be assigned to that show, and then integrate that into an RSS feed and post the RSS feed. That's the kind of thing that you could totally do automated, and you could spend like a day maybe coming up with that bash script just, you know, to make sure that it's really good and secure and fairly robust and won't crash the first time some non-standard character appears in a file name or whatever. So there are those kinds of uses, but the kind of stuff that I do, it's typically where, like Jay Rullo is saying, you know, you've got this batch of files that you need to do something to, and you could just do it manually. You could do it 15, 25, 30 times again and again. And you could even probably make it fairly simple on yourself by just copying the command out of console or something, slap it into a Kwrite document, and just copy and paste it back over with a couple modifications here and there. You know, you can create little shortcuts like that for yourself, and you can minimize how many times you have to type a line in. You know, you can do on one line, do some command, ampersand, ampersand, and then do another command, ampersand, ampersand, and then finish it up with something else. I mean, you can really, really do stuff like that, and it works. And you could even do a hybrid of that where you say, okay, I'm gonna do some command to a variable foo, ampersand, ampersand, do another command to variable foo. And then all you're doing really is assigning a new file name to variable foo, and then running that same command over and over again, which, like I say, you could have bound, you could have sitting in your clipboard, or clipper, whatever, and just keep pasting that into console or something. Totally do stuff like that. And that's not exactly the same as a loop and analyzing file names and coming up with variables to represent things that are not constant in a file name, and so on. But sometimes it does help to just sit down, take that 5-10 minutes, learn the most efficient way to do it so that you're really only entering this command once, and then run it against all these files, and it works really well. And I'm glad that that helped you out, Jay Rullo. That is obviously why I did the episode. Tim wrote me, and Tim says that the bash episode was very good. I appreciate that. And he says that the only thing I'd say is that sometimes those backticks, I like that term. I've been calling them, like, what was I calling them, accent marks or something? So backticks can lead to trouble. They are hard to read and sometimes get changed to other characters if you are cutting and pasting them. And that's fair enough because, you know, if you are cutting and pasting out of, say, console or something, or Xterm, and then you're pasting it into some other application, maybe that application's set to a different character set, maybe it's trying to be too helpful and seeing that you've got an accent mark, and surely what you really meant was a single quote, and so it substitutes that for you, or whatever. So that could be troublesome. But anyway, he says, for that reason, I tend to use the alternative, which, of course, I didn't know about, and it's for instance, chapter underscore title equals $ parentheses, grep space, quote, title, end quote, space, chap01.txt, close parentheses, instead of chapter underscore title equals backtick grep space quote title into quote space chap01.txt backtick. So obviously the $ parentheses there is being substituted for the backtick. And since I like really basic examples to get things across, you too can try this at home with simple little test, very similar to the little examples we did in episode 16 in the bash tutorial. So if you do echo, well, if you assign the variable i, the letter i, equals GNU, and then you do echo $i, of course you get GNU back, right? Remember that? And then if you do echo backtick $i, backtick, then you get that bash GNU command not found, because it's using those backticks to resolve whatever's inside of the backticks and then trying to run that as a command, and it can't find something called GNU. So now if you do the same thing, except instead of the backticks, you do echo $ parenthesis $i, close parenthesis, hit return, then it says, again, bash GNU command not found. So it is indeed doing the same thing. He also asks if I've ever tried out Vector Linux, and I'm pretty sure that I actually have met someone who used to work on Vector Linux. Nice guy. I could be wrong, but I think that's the distribution that he worked for. But anyway, I've not tried Vector Linux. I have heard of Vector Linux, and I've always been a little bit curious about it. I have heard that it was like Slackware and stuff like that, but I haven't tried it, and realistically, I probably will not. I'm pretty happy with my current solution of Slackware and Fedora. And granted, there's a Debian box lying around because Fedora no longer has PowerPC support. And actually, there's a BSD box sitting over to my right now. But I digress. Point is that the official story is that I've settled on Slackware and Fedora. Who knows? I might try Vector Linux sometime. Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to ever say never, so it could be interesting. I will say that I feel like there has to be a purposefulness to trying out a different distribution at this point in my life, this point in my Linux life, because I've gotten comfortable-ish in, like, Slackware, particularly, and even Fedora, between all the yum commands that I know, like, all two of them, and the fact that I know a couple of the different system utility configuration tools, and just kind of know where to look for stuff and how things are processed. You know, you get kind of used to these little aspects of a certain distribution, and then I find that if I switch over to something else, I mean, you can use it, but in terms of, like, trying to get it exactly how you want it, suddenly you have to start learning something new. Yeah, so it's a weird thing, and there's probably no consistency or logic to it, really. But yeah, thanks a lot for the email, Tim. I really appreciate it. Some fellow podcasting kinds of comments. Deep Geek, of course, a friend of mine from Hacker Public Radio and stuff like that, sent me a link, which I will put in the show notes, to a free ebook about bypassing internet censorship. And it's at objavi.flossmanuals.net/books/circumvention-tools-en-2009-11.02-17.18.18.pdf. Like I say, I will definitely put that into the show notes. You will find it there. I downloaded it. I skimmed it. I have not read it all yet, but it does look pretty neat, so I would check this out. Deep Geek, of course, has his new little Sony ebook reader or whatever. If you listen to Talk Geek to Me, you'll hear all about it on his on what right now is his most recent episode. I guess he's probably going to be finding lots of good e-books, which could do us all a lot of good, so I'm actually quite happy about it. But yeah, I was interested in seeing this. It looks pretty darn good. So do check that out, won't you? Soundchaser, by the way, has an Ogcast. I don't know if you've heard this. It's called Cerebral Mix. So if you go to go to ogcastplanet.org, and his is one of the Ogcasts in the Ogcast Planet, and you can go to his site, and it's a music podcast, a little bit, you know, you could say it was a little bit like Juiced Penguin or something like that, but it's all Creative Commons music, and he just handpicks lots of different music and plays it. It's really, actually really cool, so check that out. But anyway, another thing you might want to check out is Hack Radio Live, which is a show that is being, it's a mini-series, I guess, is what I would call it, within Hacker Public Radio, or a subset of Hacker Public Radio. I'm not really sure, but yeah, it's out there. It's on the Hacker Public Radio stream, and it's a good little show. It's Drake Anubis and Enigma talking about various and sundry geeky topics, which, in my opinion, is exactly what Hacker Public Radio is supposed to be about, right? Hacker Public Radio is never meant, as far as I know, to be a Linux-only show or a programming-only kind of show. Now, when I heard about it via Dave Yates, which I get the impression a lot of us did. I could be wrong, but Dave Yates talked to Enigma and I think Droops on a lot of Linux Links at one point, and they were talking about Hacker Public Radio and how people should submit shows and stuff like that. So I thought, well, that's a really great idea. And so I started submitting shows. And I guess a lot of people kind of did from that point, and it became very, very predominantly computer, Linux kind of oriented content for a while, which, hey, I have no problem with. But I also feel that it should be more than that, which is why I did, you know, movie reviews and why Hack Radio Live is now doing random stuff like hacking the Wii, hacking locks at an apartment swimming pool, electronic locks, stuff like that. So, and I mean, especially like the Wii episode, which was actually, I think, the first episode. If you hear, when I saw the topic, I just thought, wow, I'm going to be phenomenally uninterested and bored by that, because I have no interest in gaming, and I have less interest in the Wii. The Wii is not appealing to me whatsoever. If I was going to get a gaming console, the last choice in the world would be the Wii. And yet, that episode was really, really entertaining. It was, like, really cool. So, my broader point is that Hacker Public Radio at large should be this. It should be full of variety. It should be full of the things that you are interested in. Even if you think no one else is interested in them, chances are you're right. People aren't interested in them. And yet, just because of the nature of entertainment, people will listen to the show, people will get interested in it, or they'll be interested in it for the 10 minutes or the 15 minutes that you do talk about it. It doesn't have to be a life-changing event to enjoy it. You know, I'm still not interested in the Wii. I still don't want to learn how to hack it with a chameleon or do whatever, or level up or get more XP or health or mages or mana or whatever you do on the Wii. I don't care. But that doesn't change the fact that that was a good episode. So that's the theory behind Hacker Public Radio, I think. Which I think means that people should submit lots and lots of episodes. Although, to be fair, there are actually a lot of episodes sitting on their server that haven't been posted yet, so that could be a little bit of a weird back-end issue. I'm not clear exactly on what's going on with that, but I think my point was Hack Radio Live is a good little mini-series, which expanded out to saying that Hacker Public Radio was a good series, which then sort of got mogrified into Hack Public Radio needs to post more shows more often, and then it kind of fell apart from there. So, to contribute to Hacker Public Radio. That was the point. And listen to Hack Radio Live, I guess, if you want. That's about all the fellow podcaster kind of news that I have, I think. So, Ohio Linux Fest has actually posted a schedule, so if you go to ohiolinux.org, you can see the schedule of talks and things like that. There's still going to be, again this year, a early bird Friday event where they'll have lots of different talks on Friday, you know, for free as everything else is. So it's just basically bonus talks that you can go to if you want. So that'll be posted eventually. And that should have some good talks. I mean, the Friday talks are basically all the ones that they couldn't quite fit into the Saturday stuff. And as someone who was on the planning committee for Ohio Linux Fest to some degree this year, I did vote on all the talks. You know, I had input, I had a vote on which talks got selected. And I can say with a lot of certainty that talks are not rejected because they aren't considered any good. I know that personally I was trying to think about two different things. One was what would appeal to the broadest of audiences, or what was so unique that it would have a strong niche audience very, very interested in hearing about it. And the niche audience I consider to span kind of a lot. Those are kind of the specialized talks where it's like some kind of talk on how to hack on a certain program that, like, you know, maybe three people use, but everyone's interested in, you know. So that's the kind of talk that really appeals to the hardcore hackers who want to know all the details about something, even if they don't necessarily intend to use it. They're curious about it, how it works, that kind of thing. On the opposite end of the spectrum are the noobs, the newcomers, which you do get a lot of at Ohio Linux Fest. So beginning kinds of things that aren't too broad, beginning track, I guess, would sort of be what you would call it. It's not called that, but in my mind, you know, something to make sure that people coming there for a good dose of helpful information on Linux will find what they're looking for. that's what we chose, or at least I voted for Saturday, meaning that there were a lot of great talks, really good talks, my own included, that I thought, well, maybe those would be better for Friday just because, you know, they're not broad enough, they're not specialized enough to be on Saturday. They're more just really good informative talks, but not really clear on who exactly the audience would be, or if the audience was very clear, not too clear on whether they're going to be there on Saturday. And so since you're bringing in all the people on Saturday, you want talks that are going to get filled up. Whereas on Friday, okay, so if I do, for instance, personally, I was going to do a talk on Final Cut Pro for developers. Basically, a talk on what Final Cut Pro and Avid and things like that do that Linux video editing applications on a professional level should also do, and what Final Cut does that Linux video editing applications should not seek to emulate. So it was really just completely geared toward developers, not for everyday users at all. And looking at that and then looking at Saturday, I couldn't see how that would be a good match. Whether I'll do that talk on Friday or not, I'm not sure, because I don't know who's deciding on Friday talks. But the point is that just because it's Friday doesn't mean that it's, like, not as good of a talk. It just means that it didn't seem like something that would fill up a room in the three or four tracks that Ohio Linux Fest has available to it. So that's about it. I think I got more feedback than that, actually, but I don't really have access to it right now. So thanks, everyone, for writing in. Really, really appreciate it. And so that was The Bad Apples, Episode 17, Season 5. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu, and you can find me online lots of different places. You can find me at, well, you can find the show at thebadapples.info. That is thebadapples.info. Or you can go to klaatu.hackerpublicradio.org. You can find me by email at klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me on the interwebs, on the interweb messaging services, Jabber specifically, at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can find me on IRC as notklaatu, usually hanging out on irc.freenode.net in the channel Ogcast Planet. And I think that's about it. So, again, thanks for listening, and see ya.
All right, I'm stopping now.